were bored, unsettled, plagued by myself. I sat at my desk, pencil in hand, but didn't write. Felt cold and turned the radiator up, then, too hot, took my cardigan off. I'd have liked to bath, but there was no hot water. I made cocoa and put extra sugar in it. Then the sweetness nauseated me. A book? Would that do it? In the library, the shelves were lined with dead words. Nothing there could help me. There came a dash of raindrops scattering against the window, and my heart leapt. Outside, yes, that was what I needed, and not just the garden. I needed to get away, right away, onto the moors. The main gate was kept locked, I knew, and I had no wish to ask Maurice to open it for me. Instead, I headed through the garden to the farthest point from the house, where there was a door in the wall. The door, overgrown with ivy, hadn't been opened for a long time, and I had to pull the foliage away with my hands before I could open the latch. When the door swung toward me, there was more ivy to be pushed aside before I could step, a little disheveled, outside. I used to think that I loved rain, but in fact I hardly knew it. The rain I loved was genteel town rain, made soft by all the obstacles the skyline put in its path, and warmed by the rising heat of the town itself. On the moors, enraged by the wind and embittered by the chill, the rain was vicious. Needles of ice stung my face, and behind me, vessels of freezing water burst against my shoulders. Happy birthday. If I was at the shop, my father would produce a present from beneath the desk as I came down the stairs. There would be a book or books, purchased at auction and put aside during the year, and a record or perfume or a picture. He would have wrapped them in the shop, at the desk, some quiet afternoon when I was at the post office or the library. He would have gone out one lunchtime to choose a card, alone, and he would have written in it, "Love from Dad and Mother," at the desk. Alone. Quite alone. He would go to the bakery for a cake, and somewhere in the shop, I had never discovered where, it was one of the few secrets I hadn't fathomed, he kept a candle, which came out on this day every year, was lit, and which I blew out, with as good an impression of happiness as I could muster. Then we ate the cake with tea, and settled down to quiet digestion and cataloguing. I knew how it was for him. It was easier now that I was grown up than when I was a child. How much harder birthdays had been in the house. Presents hidden overnight in the shed, not from me, but from my mother, who couldn't bear the sight of them. The inevitable headache was her jealously guarded right of remembrance, one that made it impossible to invite other children in the house. Impossible, too, to leave her for the treat of a visit to the zoo or the park. My birthday toys were always quiet ones. Cakes were never homemade, and the leftovers had to be divested of their candles and icing before they could be put in the tin for the next day. Happy birthday. Father whispered the words, "Happy birthday," hilariously, right in my ear. We played silent card games where the winner pulled gleeful faces and the loser grimaced and slumped, and nothing, not a peep, not a splutter, could be heard in the room above our heads. In between games, up and down he went, my poor father, between the silent pane of the bedroom and the secret birthday downstairs, changing his face from jollity to sympathy, from sympathy back to jollity in the stairwell. Unhappy birthday. From the day I was born, grief was always present. It settled like dust upon the household. It covered every one and everything. It invaded us with every breath we took. It shrouded us in our own separate miseries. Only because I was so cold could I bear to contemplate these memories. Why couldn't she love me? Why did my life mean less to her than my sister's death? Did she blame me for it? Perhaps she was right, too. I was alive now only because my sister had died. Every sight of me was a reminder of her loss. Would it have been easier for her if we'd both died? Stupefied, I walked, one foot in front of the other, again and again and again, mesmerized. No interest in where I was heading. Looking nowhere, seeing nothing, I stumbled on. Then I bumped into something. Margaret! Margaret! I was too cold to be startled, too cold to make my face respond to the vast form that stood before me, shrouded in tent-like drapes of green, rainproof fabric. It moved, and two hands came down on my shoulders and gave me a shake. Margaret! It was Aurelius. Look at you! You're blue with cold! Quick, come with me! He took my arm and led me briskly off. My feet stumbled over the ground behind him until we came to a road, a car. He bundled me in. There was a slamming of doors, the hum of an engine, and then a blast of warmth around my ankles and knees. Aurelius opened a thermos flask and poured a mug of orange tea. Drink! I drank. The tea was hot and sweet. Eat! I bit into the sandwich he held out. In the warmth of the car, drinking hot tea and eating chicken sandwiches, I felt colder than ever. My teeth started to chatter, and I shivered uncontrollably. Goodness gracious! Aurelius exclaimed softly as he passed me one dainty sandwich after another. Dear me! The food seemed to bring me to my senses a little. What are you doing here, Aurelius? I came to give you this, he said, and he reached over to the back and lifted a cake tin through the gap between the seats. Placing the tin on my lap, he beamed gloriously at me as he removed the lid. Inside was a cake, a homemade cake, and on the cake in curly icing letters were three words, Happy Birthday, Margaret. I was too cold to cry. Instead, the combination of cold and cake set me talking. Words emerged from me, randomly, like objects disgorged by glaciers as they thaw. Nocturnal singing, a garden with eyes, sisters, a baby, a spoon. And she even owes the house, I babbled, while Aurelius dried my hair with paper towels. Your house, and Mrs. Love's. She looked through the window and thought Mrs. Love was like a fairy-tale grandmother. Don't you see what it means? Aurelius shook his head. But she told me. She lied to you, Aurelius. When you came to see her in your brown suit, she lied. She's admitted it. Bless me, exclaimed Aurelius. However did you know about that brown suit of mine? I had to pretend to be a journalist, you know. But then, as what I was telling him began to sink in, a spoon like mine, you say? And she knew the house? She's your aunt, Aurelius. And Emmeline is your mother. Aurelius stopped patting my hair, and for a long moment he stared out of the car window in the direction of the house. My mother, he murmured. There, I nodded. There was another silence, and then he turned to me. Take me to her, Margaret. I seemed to wake up. The thing is, Aurelius, she's not well. Ill? Then you must take me to her, without delay. Not ill, exactly. How to explain? She was injured in the fire, Aurelius. Not only her face, her mind. He absorbed this new information, added it to his store of loss and pain. And when he spoke again, it was with a grave firmness of purpose. Take me to her. Was it illness that dictated my response? Was it the fact that it was my birthday? Was it my own motherlessness? These factors might have had something to do with it, but more significant than all of them was Aurelius's expression as he waited for my answer. There were 101 reasons to say no to his demand, but faced with the ferocity of his need, they faded to nothing. I said yes. Reunion. My bath went some way toward thawing me out, but did nothing to soothe the ache behind my eyes. I gave up all thoughts of working for the rest of the afternoon and crept into bed, pulling the extra covers well up over my ears. Inside, I was still shivering. In a shallow sleep, I saw strange visions. Hester, and my father, and the twins, and my mother. Visions in which everyone had someone else's face, in which everyone was someone else disguised. And even my own face was disturbing to me as it shifted and altered, sometimes myself, sometimes another. Then Aurelius's bright head appeared in my dream, himself, always himself, only himself. And he smiled, and the phantoms were banished. Darkness closed over me like water, and I sank to the depths of sleep. I awoke with a headache, aches in my limbs and my joints and my back. A tiredness that had nothing to do with exertion or lack of sleep weighed me down and slowed my thoughts. The darkness had thickened. Had I slept through the hour of my appointment with Aurelius? The thought nagged at me, but only very distantly, and long minutes passed before I could rouse myself to look at my watch. For during my sleep, an obscure sentiment had formed within me. Trepidation, nostalgia, excitement, and it had given rise to a sense of expectation. The past was returning. My sister was near. There was no doubting it. I couldn't see her, couldn't smell her, but my inner ear, attuned always and only to her, had caught her vibration, and it filled me with a dark and soporific joy. There was no need to put off Aurelius. My sister would find me, wherever I was. Was she not my twin? In fact, I had half an hour before I was due to meet him at the garden door. I dragged myself heavily from my bed, and too cold and weary to take off my pyjamas before dressing, I pulled a thick skirt and sweater on over the top. Bundled up like a child on firework night, I went downstairs to the kitchen. Judith had left a cold meal for me, but I had no appetite and left the food untouched. For 10 minutes, I sat at the kitchen table, longing to close my eyes and not daring to, in case I gave in to the torpor that was inviting my head toward the hard tabletop. With 5 minutes to spare, I opened the kitchen door and slipped into the garden. No light from the house, no stars. I stumbled in the darkness. Soft soil underfoot and the brush of leaves and branches told me when I'd veered off the path. Out of nowhere, a branch scratched my face and I closed my eyes to protect them. Inside my head was a half-painful, half-euphoric vibration. I understood entirely. It was her song. My sister was coming. I reached the meeting point. The darkness stirred itself. It was him. My hand bumped clumsily against him, then felt itself clasped. "Are you all right?" I heard the question, but distantly. "Do you have a temperature?" The words were there. It was curious that they had no meaning. I'd have liked to tell him about the glorious vibrations, to tell him that my sister was coming, that she would be here with me any minute now. I knew it. I knew it from the heat radiating from her mark on my side. But the white sound of her stood between me and my words and made me dumb. Aurelius let go of my hand to remove a glove, and I felt his palm, strangely cool in the hot night, on my forehead.
"You should be in bed," he said.
I pulled at Aurelius's sleeve, a feeble tug, but enough. He followed me through the garden as smoothly as a statue on casters. I have no memory of Judith's keys in my hand, though I must have taken them. We must have walked through the long corridors to Emmeline's apartment, but that, too, has been wiped from my mind. I do remember the door. But the picture that presents itself to my mind is that it swung open as we reached it, slowly and of its own accord, which I know to be quite impossible. I must have unlocked it, but this piece of reality has been lost, and the image of the door opening by itself persists. My memory of what happened in Emmeline's quarters that night is fragmented. Whole tracts of time have collapsed in on themselves, while other events seem in my recollection to have happened over and over again in rapid succession. Faces and expressions loom frighteningly large, then Emmeline and Aurelius appear as tiny marionettes a great distance away. As for myself, I was possessed, sleepy, chilled, and distracted during the whole affair by my own overwhelming preoccupation, my sister. By a process of logic and reason, I've attempted to place into a meaningful sequence images that my mind recorded only incompletely and in random fashion, like events in a dream. Aurelius and I entered Emmeline's rooms. Our step was soundless on the deep carpet. Through one doorway, then another, we stepped, until we came to a room with an open door giving onto the garden. Standing in the doorway with her back to us was a white-haired figure. She was humming. That broken piece of melody, without a beginning, without a resolution, that had haunted me ever since I came to the house. It wormed its way into my head, where it vied with the high-pitched vibration of my sister. At my side, Aurelius waited for me to announce us to Emmeline, but I couldn't speak. The universe was reduced to an unbearable ululation in my head. Time stretched into one eternal second. I was struck dumb. I brought my hands to my ears, desperate to ease the cacophony. Seeing my gesture, it was Aurelius who spoke. "Margaret!" And hearing an unknown voice behind her, Emmeline turns. Since she was taken by surprise, there is anguish in her green eyes. Her lipless mouth pulls into a distorted O, but the humming does not stop, only veers and lurches into a shrill wail like a knife in my head. Aurelius turns in shock from me to Emmeline, and is transfixed by the broken face of the woman who is his mother. Like scissors, the sound from her lips slashes the air. For a time I am both blinded and deafened. When I can see again, Emmeline is crouched on the floor, her keening fallen to a whimper. Aurelius kneels over her. Her hands scrabble at him, and I don't know whether she means to clasp him or to repel him. But he takes her hand in his and holds it. Hand in hand. Blood with blood. He is a monolith of sorrow. Inside my head, still a torment of bright white sound. My sister. My sister. The world retreats, and I find myself alone in an agony of noise. I know what happened next, even if I can't remember it. Aurelius releases Emmeline tenderly onto the floor as he hears steps in the hall. There is an exclamation as Judith realizes she doesn't have her keys. In the time it takes her to go and find a second set, Maurice's probably, Aurelius darts toward the door and disappears into the garden. When Judith at last enters the room, she stares at Emmeline on the floor, then with a cry of alarm, steps in my direction. But at the time, I know none of this, for the light that is my sister embraces me, possesses me, relieves me of consciousness. At last. Everybody has a story. Anxiety, sharp as one of Miss Winter's green gazes, needles me awake. What name have I pronounced in my sleep? Who undressed me and put me to bed? What will they have read into the sign on my skin? What has become of Aurelius, and what have I done to Emmeline? More than all the rest, it is her distraught face that torments my conscience when it begins its slow ascent out of sleep. When I wake, I don't know what day or time it is. Judith is there, she sees me stir, and holds a glass to my lips. I drink. Before I can speak, sleep overwhelms me again. The second time I woke up, Miss Winter was at my bedside, book in hand. Her chair was plump with velvet cushions as always, but with her tufts of pale hair around her naked face, she looked like a naughty child who has climbed onto the Queen's throne for a joke. Hearing me move, she lifted her head from her reading. "Dr. Clifton has been." "You had a very high temperature." I said nothing. "We didn't know it was your birthday," she went on. "We couldn't find a card. We don't go in much for birthdays here, but we brought you some daphne from the garden." In the vase were dark branches, bare of leaf, but with dainty purple flowers all along their length. They filled the air with a sweet, heady fragrance. "How did you know it was my birthday?"
"You told us, while you were sleeping." "When are you going to tell me your story, Margaret?"
"Me? I haven't got a story," I said.
"Of course you have. Everybody has a story."
"Not me." I shook my head. In my head I heard indistinct echoes of words I may have spoken in my sleep. Miss Winter placed the ribbon at her page and closed the book.
"Everybody has a story. It's like families. You might not know who they are, might have lost them, but they exist all the same. You might drift apart, or you might turn your back on them, but you can't say you haven't got them. Same goes for stories." "So," she concluded, "everybody has a story. When are you going to tell me yours?"
"I'm not." She put her head to one side and waited for me to go on. "I've never told anyone my story, if I've got one, that is, and I can't see any reason to change now."
"I see,"
she said softly, nodding her head, as though she really did.
"Well, it's your business, of course."
She turned her hand in her lap and stared into her damaged palm.
"You are at liberty to say nothing, if that is what you want. But silence is not a natural environment for stories. They need words. Without them they grow pale, sicken, and die. And then they haunt you."
Her eyes swiveled back to me.
"Believe me, Margaret, I know."
For long stretches of time I slept, and whenever I woke, there was some invalid's meal by my bed, prepared by Judith. I ate a mouthful or two, no more. When Judith came to take the tray away, she couldn't disguise her disappointment at seeing my leavings, yet she never mentioned it. I was in no pain, no headaches, no chills, no sickness, unless you count profound weariness and a remorse that weighed heavily in my head and in my heart. What had I done to Emmeline? And Aurelius? In my waking hours I was tormented by the memory of that night. The guilt pursued me into sleep. "How is Emmeline?" I asked Judith. "Is she all right?" Her answers were indirect. Why should I be worried about Miss Emmeline when I was poorly myself? Miss Emmeline had not been right for a very long time. Miss Emmeline was getting on in years. Her reluctance to spell it out told me everything I wanted to know. Emmeline was not well. It was my fault. As for Aurelius, the only thing I could do was write. As soon as I was able, I had Judith bring me pen and paper, and propped up on a pillow, drafted a letter. Not satisfied, I attempted another and then another. Never had I had such difficulty with words. When my bed cover was so strewn with rejected versions that I despaired at myself, I selected one at random and made a neat copy. Dear Aurelius, are you all right? I'm so sorry about what happened. I never meant to hurt anyone. I was mad, wasn't I? When can I see you? Are we still friends? Margaret. It would have to do. Dr. Clifton came. He listened to my heart and asked me lots of questions. Insomnia? Irregular sleep? Nightmares? I nodded 3 times. I thought so. He took a thermometer and instructed me to place it under my tongue, then rose and strode to the window. With his back to me, he asked, "And what do you read?" With the thermometer in my mouth, I couldn't reply. "Wuthering Heights? You've read that?" "Mm-hmm." "And Jane Eyre?" "Mm." "Sense and Sensibility?" "Mm-hmm." He turned and looked gravely at me. "And I suppose you've read these books more than once?" I nodded, and he frowned. "Read and reread? Many times?" Once more I nodded, and his frown deepened. "Since childhood?" I was baffled by his questions, but compelled by the gravity of his gaze. Nodded once again. Beneath his dark brow, his eyes narrowed to slits. I could quite see how he might frighten his patients into getting well just to be rid of him. And then he leaned close to me to read the thermometer. People look different from close up. A dark brow is still a dark brow, but you can see the individual hairs in it, how nearly they are aligned. The last few brow hairs, very fine, almost invisible, strayed off in the direction of his temple, pointed to the snail coil of his ear. In the grain of his skin were closely arranged pinpricks of beard. There it was again, that almost imperceptible flaring of the nostrils, that twitch at the edge of the mouth. I'd always taken it for severity, a clue that he thought little of me. But now, seeing it from so few inches away, it occurred to me that it might not be disapproval after all. Was it possible, I thought, that Dr. Clifton was secretly laughing at me? He removed the thermometer from my mouth, folded his arms, and delivered his diagnosis. "You are suffering from an ailment that afflicts ladies of romantic imagination. Symptoms include fainting, weariness, loss of appetite, low spirits. While on one level the crisis can be ascribed to wandering about in freezing rain without the benefit of adequate waterproofing, the deeper cause is more likely to be found in some emotional trauma. However, unlike the heroines of your favourite novels, your constitution has not been weakened by the privations of life in earlier, harsher centuries. No tuberculosis, no childhood polio, no unhygienic living conditions. You'll survive." He looked me straight in the eyes, and I was unable to slide my gaze away when he said, "You don't eat enough." "I have no appetite." "L'appétit vient en mangeant."
"Appetite comes by eating," I translated.
"Exactly. Your appetite will come back, but you must meet it halfway. You must want it to come." It was my turn to frown. "Treatment is not complicated. Eat, rest, and take this." He made quick notes on a pad, tore out a page, and placed it on my bedside table. "And the weakness and fatigue will be gone in a few days." Reaching for his case, he stowed his pen and paper. Then, rising to leave, he hesitated. "I'd like to ask you about these dreams of yours, but I suspect you wouldn't like to tell me." Stonily, I regarded him. "I wouldn't." His face fell. Thought not. From the door, he saluted me and was gone. I reached for the prescription. In a vigorous scrawl, he had inked, "Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes. Take 10 pages, twice a day, till end of course. December days. Obeying Dr. Clifton's instructions, I spent 2 days in bed, eating and sleeping and reading Sherlock Holmes. I confess, I overdosed on my prescribed treatment, gulping down one story after another. Before the end of the second day, Judith had been down to the library and fetched another volume of Conan Doyle for me. She had grown suddenly kind toward me since my collapse. It wasn't the fact that she was sorry for me that altered her, though she was sorry, but the fact that now Emmeline's presence was no longer a secret in the house, she was at liberty to let her natural sympathies govern her exchanges with me, instead of maintaining a constantly guarded facade.
"And has she never said anything about the 13th tale?"
she asked me wistfully one day. "Not a word. And to you?" She shook her head.
"Never. It's strange, isn't it, after all she's written, that the most famous story of all is one that might not even exist? Just think, she could probably publish a book with all the stories missing, and it would sell like hot cakes."
And then, with a shake of the head to clear her thoughts, and a new tone,
"So what do you make of Dr. Clifton, then?"
When Dr. Clifton dropped by to see how I was doing, his eye alighted on the volumes by my bedside. He said nothing, but his nostrils twitched. On the third day, feeling as frail as a newborn, I got up. As I pulled the curtains apart, my room was flooded with a fresh, clean light. Outside, a brilliant cloudless blue stretched from horizon to horizon, and beneath it the garden sparkled with frost. It was as if during those long overcast days the light had been accumulating behind the cloud, and now that the cloud was gone there was nothing to stop it flooding down, drenching us in a fortnight's worth of illumination at once. Blinking in the brilliance, I felt something like life begin to move sluggishly in my veins. Before breakfast, I went outdoors. Slowly and cautiously, I stepped around the lawn with Shadow at my heels. It was crisp underfoot, and everywhere the sun sparkled on icy foliage. The frost-rimmed grass held the imprint of my soles, but at my side, Shadow stepped like a dainty ghost, leaving no prints. At first, the cold, dry air was like a knife in my throat, but little by little, it rejuvenated me, and I rejoiced in the exhilaration. Nevertheless, a few minutes were enough. Cheeks tingling, pink-fingered and with aching toes, I was glad to come back in, and Shadow was glad to follow. First breakfast, then the library sofa, the blazing fire, and something to read. I could judge how much better I was by the fact that my thoughts turned not to the treasures of Miss Winter's library, but to her own story. Upstairs I retrieved my pile of paper, neglected since the day of my collapse, and brought it back to the warmth of the hearth, where, with Shadow by my side, I spent the best part of the daylight hours reading. I read and I read and I read, discovering the story all over again, reminding myself of its puzzles, mysteries, and secrets. But there were no revelations. At the end of it all, I was as baffled as I had been before I started. Had someone tampered with John the Digg's ladder? But who? And what was it that Hester had seen when she thought she saw a ghost? And more inexplicable than all the rest, how had Adeline, that violent vagabond of a child, unable to communicate with anyone but her slow-witted sister, and capable of heartbreaking acts of horticultural destruction, developed into Miss Winter, the self-disciplined author of dozens of best-selling novels and, furthermore, maker of an exquisite garden? I pushed my pile of papers to one side, stroked Shadow, and stared into the fire, longing for the comfort of a story where everything had been planned well in advance, where the confusion of the middle was invented only for my enjoyment, and where I could measure how far away the solution was by feeling the thickness of the pages still to come. I had no idea how many pages it would take to complete the story of Emmeline and Adeline, nor even whether there would be time to complete it. Despite my absorption in my notes, I couldn't help wondering why I hadn't seen Miss Winter. Each time I asked after her, Judith gave me the same reply. She's with Miss Emmeline. Until evening, when she came with a message from Miss Winter herself. Was I feeling well enough to read to her for a while before supper? When I went to her, I found a book, Lady Audley's Secret, on the table by Miss Winter's side. I opened it at the bookmark and read. But I'd read only a chapter when I stopped, sensing that she wanted to talk to me.
"What did happen that night?" Miss Winter asked. "The night you fell ill?"
I was nervously glad to have an opportunity for explanation. I already knew Emmeline was in the house. I'd heard her at night. I'd seen her in the garden. I found her rooms. Then on that particular night, I brought someone to see her. Emmeline was startled. The last thing I intended was to frighten her. But she was taken by surprise when she saw us, and... My voice caught in my throat.
"This is not your fault, you know. Don't alarm yourself. The wailing and the nervous collapse, it's something Judith and I and the doctor have seen many times before. If anyone is to blame, it's me, for not letting you know sooner that she was here. I have a tendency to be overprotective. I was foolish not to tell you."
She paused.
"Do you intend to tell me whom it was you brought with you?"
"Emmeline had a baby," I said. "That's the person who came with me. The man in the brown suit." And after I'd told what I knew, the questions I didn't know the answer to came rushing to my lips, as though my own frankness might encourage her to be candid in return. "What is it Emmeline was looking for in the garden? She was trying to dig something up when I saw her there. She often does it. Maurice says it's the work of foxes, but I know that's not the truth." Miss Winter was silent and very still. "The dead go underground," I quoted. "That's what she told me. Who does she think is buried? Is it her child? Hester? Who is she looking for underground?" Miss Winter uttered a murmur, and though it was faint, it instantly awakened the lost memory of the hoarse pronouncement launched at me by Emmeline in the garden. The very words.
"Is that it?" added Miss Winter. "Is that what she said?"
I nodded.
"In twin language?"
I nodded again. Miss Winter looked at me with interest.
"You're doing very well, Margaret. Better than I thought. The trouble is, the timing of this story is getting rather out of hand. We are getting ahead of ourselves."
She paused, staring into her palm, then looked straight at me.
"I said I meant to tell you the truth, Margaret. And I do. But before I can tell you, something must happen first. It's going to happen, but it has not happened yet."
"What?" But before I could finish my question, she shook her head.
"Let us return to Lady Audley and her secret, shall we?"
I read for another half hour or so, but my mind was not on the story, and I had the impression Miss Winter's attention was wandering too. When Judith tapped at the door at supper time, I closed the book and put it to one side, and as if there had been no interruption, as if it were a continuation of the discussion we'd been having before, Miss Winter said, "If you're not too tired, why don't you come and see Emmeline this evening?" Sisters. When it was time, I went to Emmeline's quarters. It was the first time I'd been there as an invited guest, and the first thing I noticed before I even entered the bedroom was the thickness of the silence. I paused in the doorway, they hadn't noticed me yet, and realized it was their whispering. On the edge of inaudibility, the rub of breath over vocal cords made ripples in the air, soft plosives that were gone before you could hear them, muffled sibilants that you might mistake for the sound of your own blood in your ears. Each time I thought it had stopped, a hushed susurration brushed against my ear like a moth alighting on my hair, then fluttered away again. I cleared my throat.
Margaret.
Miss Winter, her wheelchair positioned next to her sister, gestured to a chair on the other side of the bed.
How good of you.
I looked at Emmeline's face on the pillow. The red and the white were the same red and white of scarring and burn damage that I'd seen before. She had lost none of her well-fed plumpness. Her hair was still the tangled skein of white. Listlessly, her gaze wandered over the ceiling. She appeared indifferent to my presence. Where was the difference? For she was different. Some alteration had taken place in her, a change instantly visible to the eye, though too elusive to define. She had lost nothing of her strength, though. One arm extended outside the coverlet, and in it she had Miss Winter's hand in a firm grip. "How are you, Emmeline?" I asked nervously.
"She is not well," said Miss Winter.
Miss Winter, too, had changed in recent days. But in her disease was a distillation. The more it reduced her, the more it exposed her essence. Every time I saw her, she seemed diminished, thinner, frailer, more transparent. And the weaker she grew, the more the steel at her center was revealed. All the same, it was a very thin, weak hand that Emmeline was grasping in the clutch of her own heavy fist. "Would you like me to read?" I asked.
"By all means."
I read a chapter. "Then she's asleep," Miss Winter murmured. Emmeline's eyes were closed. Her breathing was deep and regular. She had released her grip on her sister's hand, and Miss Winter was rubbing the life back into it. There were the beginnings of bruises on her fingers. Seeing the direction of my gaze, she drew her hands into her shawl.
"I'm sorry about this interruption to our work," she said. "I had to send you away once before, when Emmeline was ill. And now, too, I must spend my time with her, and our project must wait. But it won't be long now. And there is Christmas coming. You'll be wanting to leave us and be with your family. When you come back after the holiday, we will see how things stand. I expect..." It was the briefest of pauses. "We shall be able to work again by then."
I didn't immediately understand her meaning. The words were ambiguous. It was her voice that gave it away. My eyes leaped to Emmeline's sleeping face. "Do you mean..." Miss Winter sighed.
"Don't be taken in by the fact that she seems so strong. She's been ill for a very long time. For years I assumed I would live to see her depart before me. Then when I fell ill I was not so sure. And now it seems we are in a race to the finish line."
So that's what we were waiting for. The event without which the story could not end. Suddenly my throat was dry, and my heart was frightened as a child's. Dying. Emmeline was dying. "Is it my fault?"
"Your fault? How should it be your fault?" Miss Winter shook her head. "That night had nothing to do with it."
She gave me one of her old, sharp looks that understood more than I meant to reveal.
"Why does this upset you, Margaret? My sister is a stranger to you. And it's hardly compassion for me that distresses you so, is it? Tell me, Margaret. What's the matter?"
In part, she was wrong. I did feel compassion for her. for I believed I knew what Miss Winter was going through. She was about to join me in the ranks of the amputees. Bereaved twins are half-souls. The line between life and death is narrow and dark, and a bereaved twin lives closer to it than most. Though she was often short-tempered and contrary, I'd grown to like Miss Winter. In particular, I liked the child she had once been, the child who emerged more and more frequently nowadays. With her cropped hair, her naked face, her frail hands denuded of their heavy stones, she seemed to grow more childlike every day. To my mind, it was this child who was losing her sister. And this is where Miss Winter's sorrow met my own. Her drama was going to be played out here in this house in the coming days, and it was the very same drama that had shaped my life, though it had taken place for me in the days before I could remember. I watched Emmeline's face on the pillow. She was approaching the divide that already separated me from my sister. Soon she would cross it and be lost to us, a new arrival in that other place. I was filled with the absurd desire to whisper in her ear a message for my sister, entrusted to one who might see her soon. Only what to say? I felt Miss Winter's curious gaze upon my face. I restrained my folly. "How long?" I asked. "Days. A week, perhaps. Not long." I sat up late that night with Miss Winter. I was there again at the side of Emmeline's bed the next day, too. We sat, reading aloud or in silence for long periods, with only Dr. Clifton coming to interrupt our vigil. He seemed to take my presence there as a natural thing, included me in the same grave smile he bestowed on Miss Winter as he spoke gently about Emmeline's decline. And sometimes then he sat with us for an hour or so, sharing our limbo, listening while I read. Books from any shelf, opened at any page, in which I would start and finish anywhere, mid-sentence sometimes. Wuthering Heights ran into Emma, which gave way to the Eustace Diamonds, which faded into Hard Times, which ceded to the Woman in White. Fragments. It didn't matter. Art, its completeness, its formedness, its finishedness, had no power to console. Words, on the other hand, were a lifeline. They left their hushed rhythm behind, a counter to the slow in and out of Emmeline's breathing. Then the day faded, and tomorrow would be Christmas Eve, the day of my departure. In a way, I didn't want to leave. The hush of this house, the splendid solitariness offered by its garden, were all I wanted of the world at present. The shop and my father seemed very small and far away, my mother as ever more distant still. As for Christmas, in our house, the festive season followed too close upon my birthday for my mother to be able to bear the celebration of the birth of some other woman's child, no matter how long ago. I thought of my father opening the Christmas cards from my parents' few friends, arranging over the fireplace the innocuous Santas, snow scenes and robins, and putting aside the ones that showed the Madonna. Every year he collected a secret pile of them, jewel-coloured images of the mother gazing in rapture at her single, complete, perfect infant, the infant gazing back at her, the two of them making a blissful circle of love and wholeness. Every year they went in the trash, the lot of them. Miss Winter, I knew, would not object if I asked to stay. She might even be glad to have a companion in the days ahead, but I didn't ask. I couldn't. I'd seen Emmeline's decline. As she had weakened, so the hand on my heart had squeezed more tightly, and my growing anguish told me that the end was not far off. It was cowardly of me, but when Christmas came, it was an opportunity to escape, and I took it. In the evening, I went to my room and did my packing, then went back to Emmeline's quarters to say goodbye to Miss Winter. All the sisters' whispers had fluttered away. The dimness hung heavier, stiller than before. Miss Winter had a book in her lap, but if she'd been reading, she could see to read no longer. Instead, her eyes watched in sadness her sister's face. In her bed, Emmeline lay immobile, the covers rising and falling gently with her breath. Her eyes were closed, and she looked deeply asleep. "Margaret," Miss Winter murmured, indicating a chair. She seemed pleased that I'd come. Together we waited for the light to fade, listening to the tide of Emmeline's breath. Between us, in the sickbed, Emmeline's breath rolled in and out, in a smooth, imperturbable rhythm, soothing like the sound of waves on a seashore. Miss Winter didn't speak, and I, too, was silent, composing in my mind impossible messages I might send to my sister via this imminent traveller to that other world. With every exhalation, the room seemed filled with a deeper and more enduring sorrow. Against the window, a dark silhouette, Miss Winter stirred.
"You should have this," she said,
and a movement in the darkness told me she was holding something out to me across the bed. My fingers closed on a rectangular leather object with a metal lock. Some sort of book.
"From Emmeline's treasure box. It won't be needed any more. Go away. Read it. When you come back, we'll talk."
Book in hand, I crossed the room to the door, feeling my way by the furniture in my path. Behind me was the tide of Emmeline's breath, rolling in and out. A diary and a train. Hester's diary was damaged. The key was missing, the clasp so rusted that it left orange stains on your fingers. The first three pages were stuck together where the glue from the inner cover had melted into them. On every page, the last word dissolved into a brownish tide mark, as if the diary had been exposed to dirt and damp together. A few pages had been torn. Along the ripped edges was a tantalizing list of fragments. ABNCRTAEST. Worst of all, it seemed that the diary had some point been submerged in water. The pages undulated. When closed, the diary splayed to more than its intended thickness. It was this submersion that was going to cause me the greatest difficulty. When one glanced at a page, it was clear that it was script. Not any old script, either, but Hester's. Here were her firm ascenders, her balanced, fluid loops. Here were her comfortable slant, her economic yet functional gaps. But on a closer look, the words were blurred and faded. Was this line an L or a T? Was this curve an A or an E? Or an S, even? Was this configuration to be read as bet or lost? It was going to be quite a puzzle. Although I subsequently made a transcript of the diary, on that day the holiday train was too crowded to permit pencil and paper. I hunched in my window seat, diary close to my nose, and pored over the pages, applying myself to the task of deciphering. I managed one word in three at first. Then, as I was drawn into the flow of her meaning, the words began to come halfway to meet me, rewarding my efforts with generous revelations, until I was able to turn the pages with something like the speed of reading. In that train, the day before Christmas, Hester came to life. I won't test your patience by reproducing Hester's diary here as it came to me, fragmented and broken. In the spirit of Hester herself, I've mended and tidied and put in order. I've banished chaos and clutter. I have replaced doubt with certainty, shadows with clarity, lacuna with substance. In doing so, I may have occasionally put words into her page that she never wrote, but I can promise that if I've made mistakes, it's only in the small things. Where it matters, I've squinted and scrutinized until I'm as sure can be, that I've distinguished her original meaning. I do not give the entire diary, only an edited selection of passages. My choice has been dictated first by questions of relevance to my purpose, which is to tell the story of Miss Winter, and second by my desire to give an accurate impression of Hester's life at Angelfield. Angelfield House is decent enough at a distance, although it faces the wrong way, and the windows are badly positioned, but on approaching one sees instantly the state of dilapidation it has been allowed to fall into. Sections of the stonework are dangerously weathered, window frames are rotting, and it did look as though parts of the roof are storm-damaged. I shall make it a priority to check the ceilings in the attic rooms. The housekeeper welcomed me at the door. Though she tries to hide it, I understood immediately that she has difficulty seeing and hearing. Given her great age, this is no surprise. It also explains the filthy state of the house. But I suppose the Angelfield family does not want to throw her out after a lifetime service in the house. I can approve their loyalty, though I fail to see why she cannot be helped by younger, stronger hands. Miss Dunn told me about the household. The family has been living here with what most would consider a greatly reduced staff for years now, and it has come to be accepted as part of the way of the house. Quite why it should be so I have not yet ascertained, but what I do know is that there is, outside the family proper, only Miss Dunn and a gardener called John Digence. There are deer, although there is no hunting any more, but the man who looks after them is never seen around the house. He takes instruction from the same solicitor who engaged me and who acts as a kind of estate manager, so far as there is any estate management. It is Mrs. Dunn herself who deals with the regular household finances. I supposed that Charles Angelfield looked over the books and receipts each week, but Mrs. Dunn only laughed and asked if I thought she had the sight to go making lists of figures in a book. I cannot help but think this highly unorthodox. Not that I think Mrs. Dunn untrustworthy. From what I've seen, she gives every indication of being a good-hearted, honest woman, and it is my hope that when I come to know her better, I shall be able to ascribe her reticence entirely to deafness. I made a note to demonstrate to Mr. Angelfield the advantages of keeping accurate records, and thought that I might offer to undertake the job myself if he was too busy to do it. Pondering this, I began to think it time I met my employer, and could not have been more surprised when Mrs. Dunn told me he spends his entire day in the old nursery, and that it is not his habit to leave it. After a great many questions, I eventually ascertained that he is suffering from some kind of disorder of the mind. A great pity. Is there anything more sorrowful than a brain whose proper function has been disrupted? Mrs. Dunn gave me tea, which I pretended to drink out of politeness, but later threw in the sink, for I had no faith in the cleanliness of the teacup, having seen the state of the kitchen, and told me a little about herself. She is in her 80s, never married, and has lived here all her life. Naturally enough, our talk then turned to the family. Mrs. Dunn knew the mother of the twins as a girl and young woman. She confirmed what I'd already understood, that it is the recent departure of the mother to an asylum for the sick of mind that precipitated my engagement. She gave me such a contorted account of the events that precipitated the mother's committal that I could not make out whether the woman had or had not attacked the doctor's wife with a violin. It hardly matters. Clearly there is a family history of disturbance in the brain, and I confess my heart beat a little faster when I had it confirmed. What satisfaction is there for a governess in being given the direction of minds that already run in smooth and untrammelled lines? What challenge in maintaining ordered thinking in children whose minds are already neat and tidy? I'm not only ready for this job, I've spent years longing for it. Here I shall finally find out what my methods are worth. I inquired after the father's family. For though Mr. March is deceased and the children never knew him, still his blood is theirs and has an impact on their natures. Mrs. Dunn was able to tell me very little, though. Instead, she began a series of anecdotes about the mother and the uncle, which, if I am to read between the lines, as I am sure she meant me to, contained hints of something scandalous. Of course, what she suggests is not at all likely, not in England at least, and I suspect her of being somewhat fanciful. The imagination is a healthy thing, and a great many scientific discoveries could not have been made without it, but it needs to be harnessed to some serious object if it is to come to anything. Left to wander in its own way, it tends to lead into silliness. Perhaps it is age that makes her mind wander, for she seems a kind thing in other ways, and not the sort to invent gossip for the sake of it. In any case, I immediately put the topic firmly from my mind. As I write this, I hear noises outside my room. The girls have come out of their hiding place and are creeping about the house. They've been done no favours, allowed to suit themselves like this. They will benefit enormously from the regime of order, hygiene, and discipline that I mean to instill in the house. I shall not go out to them. No doubt they will expect me to, and it will suit my purposes to disconcert them at this stage. Mrs. Dunn showed me the rooms on the ground floor. There is filth everywhere, all the surfaces thick with dust, and curtains hanging in tatters, though she doesn't see it and thinks of them as they were years ago, in the time of the twins' grandfather, when there was a full staff. There is a piano that may be beyond saving, but I will see what can be done, and a library that may be full of knowledge once the dust is wiped and one can see what is there. The other floors I explored alone, not wanting to inflict too many stares at once on Mrs. Dunn. On the first floor I became aware of a scuffling, a whispering, and smothered giggling. I'd found my charges. They had locked the door and fell silent when I tried the handle. I called their names once, then left them to their own devices and went on to the second floor. It is a cardinal rule that I do not chase my charges, but train them to come to me. The second floor rooms were in the most terrible disorder. Dirty, but I'd come to expect that. Rainwater had come through the roof, I expected as much, and there were fungi growing in some of the rotting floorboards. This is a truly unhealthy environment in which to raise children. A number of floorboards were missing. Looked as if they'd been deliberately removed. I shall have to see Mr. Angelfield about getting these repaired. I shall point out to him that someone could fall downstairs, or at the very least twist an ankle. All the hinges need oiling, and all the door frames are warped. Wherever I went, I was followed by a squeaking of doors swinging on their hinges, a creaking of floorboards, and drafts that set curtains fluttering, though it is impossible to tell exactly where they come from. I returned to the kitchen as soon as I could. Mrs. Dunn was preparing our evening meal, and I had no inclination to eat food cooked in pots as unpleasant as the ones I'd seen, so I got stuck into a great pile of washing up, after giving the sink the most thorough scrubbing it had seen for a decade, and kept a close eye on her with the preparation. She does her best. The girls would not come down to eat. I called once, and no more. Mrs. Dunn was all for calling and persuading, but I told her that I have my methods, and she must be on my side. The doctor came to dine. As I had been led to expect, the head of the household did not appear. I had thought the doctor would be offended at this, but he seemed to find it entirely normal. So it was just the two of us, and Mrs. Dunn, doing her best to wait at table, but needing much help from me. The doctor is an intelligent, cultivated man. He has a sincere desire to see the twins improve, and has been the prime mover in bringing me to Angelfield. He explained to me at great length the difficulties I'm likely to face here, and I listened with as much politeness as I could muster. Any governess, after the few hours I have had in this house, would have a full and clear picture of the task awaiting her. But he is a man, hence cannot see how tiresome it is to have explained at length what one has already fully understood. My fidgeting and the slight sharpness of one or two of my answers entirely escaped his notice, and I fear that his energy and his analytical skills are not matched by his powers of observation. I do not criticize him unduly for expecting everyone he meets to be less able than himself, for he is a clever man, and more than that, he is a big fish in a small pond. He's adopted an air of quiet modesty, but I see through that easily enough, for I've disguised myself in exactly the same manner. However, I shall need his support in the project I've taken on, and shall work at making him my ally, despite his shortcomings. I hear sounds of an upset from downstairs. Presumably the girls have discovered the lock on the pantry door. They will be angry and frustrated. But how else can I train them to proper meal times? And without meal times, how can order be restored? Tomorrow I will start by cleaning this bedroom. I have wiped the surfaces with a damp cloth this evening, and was tempted to clean the floor, but told myself no. It will only need doing again tomorrow, when I scrub the walls and take down the curtains that are so thick with dirt. So tonight I sleep in dirt, but tomorrow I shall sleep in a bright, clean room. It will be a good beginning. For I plan to restore order and discipline to this house, and to succeed in my aim must first of all make myself a clean room to think in. No one can think clearly and make progress if she's not surrounded by hygiene and order. The twins are crying in the hall. It is time for me to meet my charges. I have been so busy organizing the house that I've had little time for my diary lately, but I must make the time, for it is chiefly in writing that I record and develop my methods. Emmeline I have made good progress with, and my experience with her fits the pattern of behaviour I've seen in other difficult children. She is not, I think, as badly disturbed as was reported, and with my influence will come to be a nice child. She is affectionate and sturdy, has learned to appreciate the benefits of hygiene, eats with a good appetite, and can be made to obey instructions by kind coaxing and the promise of small treats. She will soon come to understand that goodness rewards by bringing the esteem of others in its wake. And then I will be able to reduce the bribery. She will never be clever, but then I know the limits of my methods. Whatever my strengths, I can only develop what is there to start with. I'm content with my work on Emmeline. Her sister is a more difficult case. Violence I've seen before, and I'm less shocked than Adeline thinks by her destructiveness. However, I am struck by one thing. In other children, destructiveness is generally a side effect.